Chapter 2, Thailand and Tucson, 1969 to 1973. As high school graduation neared, I was not looking forward to my future. I didn't fear it, but I didn't feel brave about it either. I attributed the social, psychological, and emotional trials I suffered through adolescence to three things: high school, living at home, and just being an adolescent. I had a few ideas about what I wanted to do. More important, I knew exactly what I did not want to do. I did not want anything to do with college. I wasn't ready for it on many levels. My dad wanted me to go to a community college, live at home, and work part-time. It would have been the smartest thing to do, but I wanted nothing to do with any of that. He even set up a job interview for me to work on the sports desk for the newspaper. I'm not sure what that job would have entailed, but half an hour after I purposely blew the interview, I put my quickly thought-out plan into action, went to the Air Force Recruiting Center, and signed up for a delayed enlistment program. I had 3 months before I would actually take the pledge, but the die was cast. This was in June 1969. I was 19. The Vietnam War was in full swing. I had a low lottery number and would more than likely have been drafted had I not volunteered. I had sense enough to know that whatever I did in the Air Force would be a lot safer than anything I would do in the Army or Marines. My mom took it in stride. My dad was not thrilled. I think he was looking forward to having me around for a few more years. In the end, though, he was very supportive. As I was going through the psychological and emotional shock of basic training and the military world in general, he kept my morale high by sending me regular letters filled with news from home. Although the Air Force paid me, I didn't consider my time in the service as one of my jobs. My duties, for which I was well trained, consisted of processing aerial film. Specifically, my unit in Thailand received 5-inch wide rolls of film, the original negatives, usually shot from the bottom of an F-4 fighter jet. We made copies of the film so it could be distributed throughout the intelligence community. I spent 8 weeks in basic training in Texas and then 6 months in Denver for photo processing school. I served a year in Thailand, 6 months in Mountain Home, Idaho, and a year in Tucson, Arizona. For my last year of service, I went back to Thailand. Only during my 2 tours in Thailand did I actually do any photo processing. In Idaho, we trained. In Tucson, that was where my next job took place. I arrived at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Tucson in 1972. After settling into the barracks, we met our squad commander, a career tech sergeant named Sergeant Poland. He was probably a nice enough guy. He looked like a tall Elmer Fudd, but other than yelling at me all the time, had none of Elmer's speech issues. He also had a pipe permanently stuck in the crook of his mouth. I'm sure he was bored with his current assignment, or pissed because at 50-something years old, he had to continually deal with a bunch of rambunctious and sometimes rebellious 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. Our assignment was to learn how to take down and reassemble the portable connecting trailers, our darkrooms. Although we never mobilized in the traditional sense, we still had to know how to take down and reassemble these trailers. At every base I was ever stationed, these trailers were already up and running and worked just fine. After 2 weeks of babysitting us, Sergeant Poland came up with a truly wonderful idea. We normally trained Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. He figured it would be much easier to manage a few of us each day instead of the whole squad. So he decided that we all had to show up every day for roll call. This was to make sure we didn't leave town. We were required to stay for 8 hours, but only one day a week. The other 6 days we were off. It got better. Barrack space was at a premium. Dick, a fellow protector of peace, liberty, and the American way, and I put our names on a list for off-base living. Maybe because we had been in the service for a couple of years, we were given preference. For whatever reason, the Air Force decided to pay our rent for a 2-bedroom bungalow with a pool 5 miles from the base. It was a horseshoe-shaped complex, and the pool was in the middle. More accurately, the pool was 15 feet from our front door. It still got better. With all this time on our hands and living off base, we decided we might as well get civilian jobs to supplement our tequila, marijuana, and Coors beer habits. This is where my experience as a shoe salesman really came in handy. A local department store bought a truckload of Capizio shoes. For the uninformed, Capizios are fine Italian shoes specifically designed for women with petite feet. It would be a temporary job, maybe 8 months. Dick and I were a couple of clean-cut, intelligent-looking 20-year-olds who must have impressed the manager or else we passed the mirror test. In either case, we got hired. This was back in the days when virtually every shoe store employed salesmen or women who used a little sloping stool for ease in getting the new shoe on the customer's foot. We also used a brannock, the sliding metal device for measuring foot length and width. It was an incredibly boring and tedious job, the monotony of which was sometimes broken up by the occasional plus-size customer who insisted she could squeeze her so-called petite foot into the shoe she insisted was the correct size. Of course, measuring the feet of a hot-looking 30-year-old was much more fun. In Ms. Plus-Size's defense, Capizios were cut for a narrow foot and calf. I can't remember how many boot zippers I had to soap to work a beautiful leather boot up some of those bulging calves. But it was a lot. Some women just had to have those Capizios. Every now and then, a mother and her good-looking teenage daughter would grace my department. More than once, a mother would smack the side of her daughter's knees to remind her to keep her legs together. Sometimes it was impossible not to stare. Occasionally, some fairly nice-looking women seemed to open their legs on purpose, knowing we had a good close-up view. It was very difficult to stare and not get caught. It was also very difficult to determine if this was a come-on from the good-looking babe shoe buyer or someone who happened to consider shoe salesmen invisible non-entities. Probably the latter. I should ask Ed Bundy. I did manage to do some serious smooching with one of the sales girls who must have been blinded by my good looks and worldliness. It had to be that because she never saw me in my uniform. We managed to carry on these brief moments of passion in the back room against a wall of neatly stacked boxes of shoes. The other good thing about this shoe sales job, aside from the extra money, was that we became friends with a great group of civilians. I don't think that was normally the case. Most military people hung out with their own. Also, this was the time when anti-war sentiment ran pretty high and long-haired hippies were the norm. I believe our winning personalities cut through the prejudices. We were a gang of eight, 6 guys and 2 women. With ample time off, lots of extra money, and the ignorance and energy of youth, we spent the year drinking beer, smoking dope, eating psilocybin mushrooms, hanging out, and taking an occasional drive down on Nogales, Mexico to stock up on tequila. Naturally, we call these trips the tequila runs. On Thursday nights, we'd hang out at the Poco Loco Bar on Speedway Boulevard, dancing and listening to the bluegrass band Dusty Chaps, swilling down buck 25 pitchers of draft beer and getting stoned in the parking lot during breaks. Technically, I was protecting America's democratic way of life. As you can see, some sacrifices were harder to make than others. Although I have had many good and memorable years in my life, that year in Tucson ranks right at the top. After Tucson, I was shipped back to Thailand to continue doing what I was marginally good at, making duplicates of aerial film. This next part is not about a job. It's what happened after I got home from my job. Instead of an off-the-base GI existence with the Thai natives employed as maids and servants, I lived in a small village in Udon Thani province, the only GI living among the natives. I didn't get too far in learning the Thai language, but my efforts were appreciated. I would often get invited to dinner in the village chief's bungalow, where I would sit, cross-legged and barefoot on the floor, stumbling through a conversation, sharing a meal with him, his extended family, and a few neighbors. My 3-room teak bungalow was right across the yard, past the communal water spigot. I had 1 room for sleeping, and the second very small room set up with a gas burner, a small refrigerator, and a few shelves. The 3rd room was the bathroom. The toilet was a traditional low-to-the-ground squat toilet that one flushed by pouring in half a bucket of water. To shower, I doused myself with cold water from my 30-gallon clay container, soaped up, and then doused myself again. Depending on the season, I collected this water from my rain barrel or from the spigot outside my door. In the winter, I took the sissy route and heated the water first. I was really comfortable in this setup and thoroughly enjoyed my immersion into the Thai lifestyle. Another character in the neighborhood who really enjoyed me and my bungalow was a stray cat that showed up one day after work, sitting on my porch. The first time he showed up, I walked around him, went into my makeshift kitchen, poured him a small bowl of milk, and set it outside. Apparently, that was all I needed to do. The cat showed up every time he heard the door keys come out of my pocket. I'd pick up dried fish at the market to go along with his milk. For the most part, I left him on the porch. Every now and then I'd hear a loud hiss, then a dog yelping. I suspected the cat was protecting his territory and deserved a reward. So one night I let the cat in. He jumped up on the bed as if returning to his regular spot. I sat down next to him and fired up my one and only joint for the evening. After a couple of hits for myself, I gently cupped the cat's face in my palms and blew a stream of smoke into his. He blinked a few times, walked around in three slow circles, plopped down on the mattress, and lay there for the next 2 hours in Kitty La La Land. For the rest of my time in Thailand, this was our regular routine. I'd come home, let the cat in, take a shower, get something to eat, and then we'd both get stoned. During my last year in the service in Thailand, the Air Force let individuals transfer to any unit on the base so that they could pick up a little experience in occupations that they might pursue in civilian life. I chose the still photography unit. I developed an interest in photography in high school while watching my brother Robert work in his makeshift darkroom in the basement. The first camera I ever used was a copy camera for producing printer-ready art for the school newspaper. Although I had the academic scores to go into still photography when I joined the Air Force, there were no openings. That's why I ended up processing aerial film, the closest thing to it. By the time I got to this unit of choice, I'd already had plenty of still photography experience from using the Minolta camera I bought during my first tour in Thailand. I was also fairly accomplished in the darkroom. I had a good sense of composition. Working in the still photo unit on base would not be a huge leap. Still, I learned a lot. My assignments are usually restricted to on-base award ceremonies and squadron group pictures. My photos had been published many times in Stars and Stripes, one of the Armed Forces newspapers. Much to my amazement, one day I was assigned to ride in the doorway of a helicopter to take aerial shots of various Thai Air Force bases. I was very excited. The assignment didn't start until 6 p.m. It had something to do with the quality of light. At the appointed time, we piled into the helicopter. I was instructed to sit in the open doorway with my feet dangling in the air. This would give me the best angle when we banked around and over the target areas. I was strapped in and wore a helmet with a radio link to the co-pilot and the colonel in charge. I was really excited and ready to go. Here I was, 22, indestructible, and not afraid of heights. I put a fresh roll of film into the camera, gave a thumbs up to the pilot, and we took off. Sitting in the doorway of a helicopter with my feet hanging over the edge was just what I expected it to be, incredibly fun. I had a goofy grin on my face for nearly the entire time. I took 6 or 7 shots of each base. We had one base to go, and the light was going to fail us fairly soon if we didn't hurry. I started to put in a new roll of film. As soon as I hit the release button to rewind the first roll, I realized I did not have the film properly attached to the take-up spool to begin with. In short, I may have pressed the shutter button 18 times, but I had not captured a single image of the bases. My smile disappeared. The flight was no longer fun. I suddenly had the all-too-familiar queasy feeling in my stomach that told me I had really fucked up. I didn't hesitate to tell a co-pilot. What choice did I have? I suppose I could have released my safety straps and jumped out, but I figured that a good ass-chewing was much better than death by splattering. I was quite wise at that age. Colonel, we have a problem. Naturally, everyone aboard was pretty pissed. The end result was that after only 3 months in the still photo unit, I was unceremoniously reassigned to the flight line, where my job for the last 3 months of my illustrious military career was to ferry fighter pilots back and forth from their jets for their missions over Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, or wherever they went. Before I wrap up my Air Force history, I have to mention my encounter with Jane Fonda when I was stationed in Mountain Home, Idaho for 6 months. While there, I hooked up with a small band of fellow GIs who just happened to be anti-war. I wasn't anti-war at the time. In reality, the Air Force was the only thing that enabled me to cut the cord and get out of Lakewood, Ohio. I was hanging out with them because there really wasn't much to do in Mountain Home, Idaho. One day I was downtown in the empty movie theater listening to these four anti-war GIs try to perfect the one and only tune they knew, Papa John's Farm. Hearing it today still makes me want to puke because I heard these idiots practice it ad nauseum. They were so entertained by their accidental ability to harmonize they couldn't stop repeating the song. While I was sitting there in the theater, Donald Sutherland and Jane Fonda walked in. They were part of an FTA, Fuck the Army, show with Country Joe and the Fish. I don't think I saw Country Joe, the Fish, or the actual show. At this moment, though, Jane Fonda sat down next to me. We were the only two sitting in the theater. I don't know where Don went. I call him Don now. Anyhow, I knew it was Jane Fonda. I wasn't nervous because I was sitting next to Jane Fonda. I was nervous because I was sitting next to a really good-looking babe. That hasn't changed. I still get nervous around really beautiful women. I looked at her and said, "Hi." Jane looked at me and said, "Hi." I then took the plunge and said, "How are you?" "Fine," she says. "And you?" "Fine," I said. And that was it. After 15 seconds of silence, I started to feel like the tongue-tied dipshit that I usually feel like in those situations and made an unceremonious exit. In retrospect, maybe I'm looking at this all wrong. She wasn't Miss Conversationalist either. Possibly really good-looking guys made her nervous, right?